The reason why we don't understand energy, or free energy, is because we don't understand energy. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. It originates from the ether, and the ether is a plane of existence which vibrates beyond the highest frequency of physical existence, is where the beginning of the frequency of the ether starts. And it provides the life force for all creatures, including circuits, our creatures. We talk about a live circuit versus a dead circuit. The electrical energy that animates that circuit is the life force. But it's composed of ingredients, and this is where the fascinating part comes in. And also, this is the fundamental mechanics of consciousness expressed in the physical plane, is the life force, is one way to look at the expression of consciousness, is the life force. Well, it turns out that the ingredients of energy are also its containment, are also, more significantly, its level of efficiency. So when these ingredients of efficiency, namely reactants, come together to form energy, we lose sight of their efficiency, and now it's just raw energy, which has no efficiency to it whatsoever, except that unless this energy is filtered or processed through singular ingredients of itself, namely capacitive reactants, inductive reactants, frequency, duration, and phase relation is not so much an ingredient, so much as a diagnostic check, but it's an important one nonetheless as to what's going on. So we could almost call it a pseudo factor of reactants. Because it is significant, but it's not fundamental, let's say. In any case, these containers of energy are its ingredients that make up energy when they are combined to kind of become amorphous and lose their individuality and the magnitudes of their individuality, such as Farads, Henrys. Now, the Henrys get turned into amps, and the Farads get turned into volts. I've always suspected these relationships, but I didn't quite understand it. Well, we know that reactive power and real power are convertible one into the other, and yet reactive power is an oxymoron it's a contradiction actually, because it doesn't measure as energy. It's not power. It's the square root of -1. There's no way we could measure it. Yet it's there, intrinsically speaking. It's kind of hibernating, you know. It's suspended animation. We can't really use it when it's the container. We can't use the container as energy. But we can combine the ingredients of containment to become energy, and then we can use it. So it's this interesting anomaly in that the noun becomes the verb. The container, the noun, becomes the verb. The energy is the process or the use of that becomes work when it's applied. And vice versa, the verb can turn into the noun. But there's another way to look at the container, and that's efficiency. Excuse me. Because the trend and the limit, the asymptotic limit, you can never reach it, but it goes in that direction. The asymptotic direction, the vector, the direction of the vector, and the asymptotic limit of that vector. I'm preceding what I'm going to say, a list of, I think, two items, and that's what I'm going to list. So the vectorial limit of energy is zero. And we know this because of the nature of the trend is entropy. Yet, the direction and the asymptotic limit of reactance, or also known as efficiency in humanistic terms, is infinity. And they are not, even though you can translate one into the other, their embodiment in a circuit, let's say, of the behavior of a live circuit, are not tied to each other, and they're not tethered to each other in a strict manner. At any point in time, yes, they are. So we say, ooh, conservation of energy. And this is where conservation of energy breaks down. It's only a moment-to-moment assessment in which we say energy is conserved, and so the energy that got converted into reactive power, I should say the real power that got converted into reactive power, has been conserved, but not over time. See, this is where the thing breaks down. Energy does not involve time, because time is one of the factors of reactance, but it disappears into energy when the factors combine to create energy. So time is useless as a term, and yet conservation of energy is predicated on a consistency of time. Time cannot change. It can't speed up, slow down, or go backwards, or else conservation is lost. It's no longer there. It's no longer upheld. Well, the factor of reactance known as time, or duration, or frequency, or its sidekick, phase relation, those things only exist in the field of reactance, not in the field of energy. And yet the field of reactance is merely the components of energy, which results in its efficiency of use. So efficiency of use is a consequence of reactance, but it's a very significant one. And this is what I've been focusing on of late. But, okay, let me get back to the tethering, though. I have to finish that thought. The tethering, the conservation of energy, the conserved relationship of tethering between the conversion equivalence between reactive power and real power is only during each moment. Because when we look at this relationship, this tethering relationship between real power and reactive power over time, now we're looking at it in terms of reactance, not in terms of energy. So we can't have conservation of energy over time. This is where we break down. We just assume that it is, but it's not. It's only at a particular moment. Because the minute we get time into the situation, moments over time, moments of measurement, of quantification, moments of magnitude over time, we lose conservation, because time is a factor of reactance, and reactance does not come under the umbrella of conservation, because it's not energy. It's the components of energy, which are not conserved. This is where efficiency changes, wherein you can have a different rate of efficiency, namely reactance, at the input versus the output. Because the output is a different point in time. And reactance, all of the factors of reactance cannot be conserved, each and every one of them. They are not subject to conservation. They are subject to dilation. Just time alone, as an example, is a factor of reactance that can dilate. You know, it can change its speed, it can change its direction, and so energy can't be conserved under those conditions. And so consequently, when we just look at this in a logical way, that means that over time, energy cannot be conserved. It's only at each moment that it is conserved. And this is the point that is lost on anybody who talks or thinks about free energy. Because we say the physics exclamation or pronouncement, or, yeah, the physical pronouncement that energy is conserved, but it can't be over time conserved. It cannot be. It's impossible. It's a fundamental error of definition of terms to assume that it can when we've already stated that it cannot be. As a consequence of our definitions of all of these actors on the stage of dynamic behavior. Let's put it that way. Leave out electricity. We don't need to call it thermodynamic or electrodynamic because it's all the same. It's the dynamism of existence. So do you understand the logic? The logic alone, if we think through, and Krishnamurti was a yogi saint, who it's hard to take him seriously sometimes because he was so negative. I mean, if you see YouTube videos of him, my God, it's like the guy is not somebody you want to hang around. He's a yogi. He's a saint. Come on, you know. But he was suffering the most excruciating, unforgivable sin, which only saints go through in full force. It means he was some kind of Hitler in the past, you know, some dude who really, really screwed himself by screwing other people. He screwed his future self by screwing a lot of people in his past. And so he was in constant pain. The turmoil was, oh my God, it was on all levels, emotional, physical, and mental, 24/7, he was in constant pain on all levels of his existence. And so it's no small wonder that he was so negative. But sometimes some gem of truth got through. It always gets through the muck that he was living in. And one of the things he stated is that the human has this tendency to error in the area of logical thinking. We don't take our line of reasoning all the way to its conclusion. And you know, if you did, you know, that's actually a process in ancient Greek thought. It's considered a path. I forget the name of it. I knew the name when I was 15, but that's a long time ago. But it has to do with following the path of logic back to the source. So wherever the thought of a logical line of reasoning came from, you go in reverse direction. You know, whatever the logical direction is, you reverse it and you go back to its source. Well, Krishnamurti was referring to the goal. We never take it to the end result. And it turns out the end result is the same as the source. In yoga, that's basically the understanding. All things come back to the beginning because everything runs in cycles, and the passage of a cycle, we're more evolved when we come back to the terminus, which is the beginning point. Each time we do, we're on a higher plane of existence. Anyway, hopefully that's the first credo of creation is all things must grow, and that's the name of the creator in Sanskrit, Ishwara, progression, Shwara, all creatures. And a creature is a subject is an object is a subject. There's no difference between the two because all objects are animated with dynamism, meaning consciousness, or the expression of consciousness, I should say. Prana, or life force, is in one expression of consciousness. There are three expressions. One is divinity, in which you want to get something done, you refer to the deity in charge, or the demigod, or whatnot. You make obeisance to them, you plead with them to get the job done. However it is they do it, you don't want to know, you just want it to get done. And the way to do it is you go to the supervisor. You don't go to the person in charge. And you make sure the supervisor makes his underling take care of the job. So if you want it to rain, you don't go to the moon, who's in charge of the rain, you go to the sun to tell the moon what to do. That's the main branch, or the main way of looking at dynamic existence. Then there are two offshoots. One has to do with the arts, and the other has to do with the sciences. The arts have to do with vibration, and that's the life force, prana, while the sciences have to do with functionality, and that's expressed by mathematics. But it's also expressed by the siddhis, the so-called yogi powers, you know, walking through walls, levitating. I mean, you ever stop to think the functional power it takes for a little baby to learn how to crawl and then walk on its hind legs and not fall over? We take it for granted, but that's a function, a skill. Any skill is a function, or a combination of functions, I should say, that we have to learn, and once we learn it, we take it for granted. But that's, you can mathematically map out, and engineers do it all the time, what the walking procedure is. Or else we wouldn't have computer graphical animations of a stick figure walking if we didn't know what the mathematics was. And this is what simulators do, and they simulate a live circuit. It's all mathematics because it's the functionality. Okay? So this is the way to look at reality. but the main point of this recording is to look at the relationship between reactance and energy is only strictly conserved as a tethering equivalency within each moment of time. And of course, I'm not even going to go into the realm of what is a moment, because I can't tell you what it is. But we all talk about it as if it exists, so let's just assume that it does, you know, and maybe a fiction of the mind for all we know. And yet it's a useful one, because we know over time, moment to moment, energy cannot be conserved. So it is a useful concept. It does serve a useful purpose, whether or not we actually know what we're talking about when we refer to it. Oh, God. Don't you just love... This is why Socrates was so negative, and probably why Krishnamurti was driven to such negativity, because Socrates kept saying, well, you can't really know anything, really, ultimately. And you know what I get out of that? Plato going and listening to him talk like that over and over again had the inverse result. Instead of Plato becoming another Socrates, and I don't think anybody can, Socrates was a unique individual all to himself. You just can't replicate him in any of his students or anyone. I mean, unless Krishnamurti comes close. Maybe Socrates had his own hell to go through, I suppose. But to come up with such a negative attitude that we can never really know anything. But Plato was being a little more optimistic, because he went in the opposite, as a consequence of listening to Socrates, he went in the opposite direction. And he gave us all of this analysis of knowledge that he had acquired, inspired such as he was by Socrates and by all of life surrounding Plato. You know, Socrates had a big impact on Plato's analysis of reality, which is the very thing Socrates said Plato and all of us are intrinsically, fundamentally incapable of doing to any degree of satisfaction. We're always going to come short. We're always going to make an error of judgment in our analysis of something, because we can never completely know anything. Yet that doesn't stop us from trying, and that certainly didn't prevent Plato from, with gusto, leaping headfirst into the field of analysis and summation of knowledge. So, you know, it's, you know, when you look at disciples of gurus and the lineage there that results, they tend to alternate. So if you assess one yogi saint, or just one yogi in the chain of yogis, in that particular heritage, that lineage, their qualities they're cyclic, and they invert, they oscillate between opposite qualities. Of whatever quality that you're assessing one yogi, his disciple will usually be the opposite, and his disciple will be back to the first one. So, and it works that way in human psychology. You'll find the children rebel against their parents in adolescence, and then their children end up becoming the same as the very parent that they rebelled against. But this is the field of duality, in which we know, in which things oscillate, they go in cycles. Anyway, so I'm not going to repeat myself for emphasis sake, because that's just going to make, but do you get what I was focusing on? This nature of that energy cannot be conserved over time, because time is a factor of energy, namely a factor of reactance, which is an ingredient of energy when we take energy apart. So when we take energy apart and analyze it, we've frozen it in time. No, the opposite. See? I've made the boo-boo. We have taken it outside of its momentary existence and looked at the big picture of how energy changes over time, because it can change, conservation notwithstanding. It's only within each moment of time that energy cannot change. So that it, now this is very interesting, because we look at delta energy over delta time all the time. We do that all the time. And yet conservation has nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. Because for that to be the case, which is what science proclaims, but I am saying, no, that's not true. In order for that to be the case, we would have to have no duration, and thus no frequency, and no phase relation. Time would have to disappear in order for time to shrink to a moment and not exist as anything outside a moment. So now in physics, they call that the germinus to the Big Bang, don't they? The kernel before it explodes and becomes the dynamic existence of creation. It's just this period prior to the Big Bang in which time is frozen. Well, that's true already all the time, moment to moment. So you see, Big Bang just didn't happen one time, you know? It's all the time, because it's really the way we analyze time is what the Big Bang amounts to. The creative process is an all-time reality. It's not something that just happened one time. That's the thinking, the ideology, the idioticology of the Judeo-Christian mentality, that creation happened at a beginning. In the beginning, Genesis, in the beginning, blah, blah, blah. There was no beginning, because the beginning is all the time. It's an aspect of time. When we analyze time, then we break it down into beginning, middle, and an end. A beginning, initiation, a process of dynamism, and a terminus. But that's just an analysis. That's a creation of the human mind analyzing the situation, which the situation calls for the analysis and is capable of the analysis, which means the analysis is intrinsic. That analysis is intrinsic to time. But it's not, we usually don't see it expressed. Well, we do see it expressed, that's right. You see, things in reality tend to be complicated. And that's why we're constantly analyzing, coming up with new aspects of knowledge in analyzing a situation. Because the intricacy of any aspect of creation, reality, whatever you want to call it, is very, very complicated. And I think it's inherently designed to be, because of the interconnectedness of all things. And if you consider the vastness, not of material creation, but the vastness of knowledge of both material and immaterial, the subtle planes of creation that are not physical, such as the ether. Because of this interconnectedness, there is going to be no end of analysis. The combinatorial ways that you can relate one thing to another thing and come up with a conclusion and an opinion differing from somebody else's opinion or your own over time just by taking a different point of view. Even though your field of view is the same, if you take a different point of view, you end up with a different conclusion. So it's amazing how fascinating knowledge can be. It's probably an endless, a bottomless pit you just fall into and keep falling. Right. See? It's an infinite falling in love with knowledge. Because there's no end to knowledge. You can fall deeply in love with it and become more and more fascinated by it because there's no end to knowledge. So there's no end to your love affair with knowledge. See? This is very interesting. This means that knowledge is a path to God because God is infinity, right? Which means you keep falling and you never stop falling. There's this scene in Journey to the Center of the Earth, Brendan Fraser picture, in which he and his two companions are falling in a volcanic tube for thousands of miles. And they somehow survive as they gradually break their fall, but into a cascade of a waterfall. But they don't get skewered by stalagmites or stalactites or whatever they're called, lying at the bottom. But they're falling. They're hanging there in space. And that's also a scene in Bill and Ted's one of their excellent adventure movies. I can't remember which one, the first one or the second one, in which they're endlessly falling into hell. Well, eventually they get there, but technically, no, you wouldn't never get there. It's a process of falling into hell. There is no place to get to. And then when you decide, well, I think I've had enough of this, then you turn around and you start ascending to heaven. You know, heaven and hell are not places, they're vectorial directions because their asymptotic limits are zero and infinity, which can never be reached. We can talk about them, we can talk about reaching them, going in that direction, but they are asymptotic. You will never get there. You'll just keep getting there. So their significance is the vector, because that's a function of what direction you take and the consequences thereof. And it's okay to have a goal that you cannot reach. It's okay. Because now it defines the process of your becoming the goal or becoming located at that goal. And that function is significant and it can be mathematically defined, you know. So we know it's a function if it can be mathematically defined. Anyway. So this is a very weird, you know, this almost, and I have to end with this similitude, in which from philosophy, metaphysical philosophy or spiritual philosophy, that when you take ingredients and you put them together, you get something that's no longer the ingredients. Oh, this is synergy. This is where Buckminster Fuller came up with the term called, and he called it synergy. In which the whole is greater than, or different. It's not merely greater, it's more complicated. And it's different than the sum of its parts. It's more than just greater. It's more complicated, it's more intricate, it's just a different reality. But in this case, it's the other way around. When we go to the parts, it becomes complicated. When we go to the amorphous whole, it's amorphous. It's unity. You can't say anything about it. And this is really why we usually say that God is not something you can define, because all of the factors of God get smeared into this amorphality of unity that doesn't have any qualification to it in a state of unity. But when you start to analyze it, you break it down into its factors. And now you can talk about it ad infinitum, all the different qualities that went to make up that amorphous unity of bliss that never changes. It's just bliss. It just goes on, bliss, you know. Very boring from the standpoint of analysis because there's nothing there to change. It's a field of non-change because it's a field of unity. In which factors don't exist anymore. Analysis does not exist anymore. It's just bliss. Unending, non-changing bliss. And so delta no longer is there. Delta time, delta energy, It's gone because it's in a state of union. Does that help qualify the situation? So a moment of time, I'll take a guess, is a point of union. While a field of those points, namely over time, a duration of moments of time, is the analytical breakdown of that unity of a moment of time. It sounds weird to call a duration an analytical breakdown of each moment of that duration. Doesn't that sound bizarre? That a duration is the outcome of each moment interacting with every other moment. As the moments create this field of change, so it can't be in a state of unity, and it's in the field of analysis, which means everything's been broken down into its parts. And when you analyze those parts, you find out that electrical energy, as the easiest way of phrasing this, cannot uphold conservation because it's no longer in a state of unity with itself. The unity has been broken. When you look at time longer than the duration of a single moment, conservation cannot be upheld because union has been broken. The unity of whatever it is we're looking at has been broken down into the analysis of its parts. And when that happens, it's a loose association at that point, and you can do whatever you like. Once you put that duration back together again as a singularity of moment, it'll look like the energy value has changed. And this is the mistake that simulators make time and time again, because they've been programmed to do that. To look at duration in terms of a single moment. And so they'll chart it out. How many amps? How many volts are the outcome of the duration of a circuit simulation? And it won't necessarily be the same. It might be if it's a flashlight circuit, if you look at it as if it's a flashlight circuit, as if reactants disappeared entirely. Well, that can't happen over time. It can only happen at a moment in time. And so they give you amps and they give you volts. But when they simulate, the simulator simulates the behavior of a circuit over or duration of time. Now, all of a sudden, we get to utilize capacitive reactants, inductive reactants. Yeah, because we're looking at energy over time. The change of energy over time. There's no way energy can maintain itself over time. It's impossible. And a simulator shows that. The amps moves this way, and then it moves that way. Now, people will claim that, physicists will claim that it has to be conserved over time. No, that's because they've frozen time that they make that statement. But if you don't freeze time they've narrowed their vision down to a single moment of time. It's really a game of denial, like, you know, an alcoholic, you know. You put blindfolds on, and then you claim that you turn your back on someone. They don't exist to me anymore. I'm no longer friends with them. And they're not even my enemy. I don't even know that they exist anymore. This is literally the attitude we take when we look at time, over duration. We freeze it into a single moment, and then, okay, energy has been conserved in that moment. But, oh my God. But in order for energy to move and change and have dynamics, no, that's not true. You know, that's what they'll claim. So I look at the big picture, and physicists don't. They look at a frozen view of the world. Isn't that what an electron microscope does? And it's so popular. Oh, you can go buy yourself an electron microscope if you like. But try and go and find a single instance of a working version of a Royal Raymond Rife microscope that deals with living organisms over time at degrees of magnification greater than what an electron microscope can give you. Good luck. There is no working model. There's a few are sitting in either private possession or museums, you know, of sorts, but they're not a working model anymore, and nobody knows how to build it. He did. He figured out how to reduce magnification of a living organism to be less than the wavelength used to look at it, the wavelength of light. How to do that using very special gel prisms and solid whatever prisms. I mean, the guy was a genius, but he became an alcoholic because he was shut out of the medical profession for his invention. They didn't want it. Him to solve, to have a tool at the disposal of doctors to solve any illness caused by any disease, germ, or virus, to be able to look at the behavior of that virus and figure out what to kill it with, without harming the host. I mean, it's truly remarkable what technology has been shut out of our use just because it's not good for business. Our economy would collapse and we'd no longer have competition. You know, the freedom to steal consumers from other vested interests and thus steal money, the flow of money, the flow of profits. I mean, it's a ridiculous world we live in. It's highly efficient, but it's very inhumane. And it's so unscientific, so unscholarly, but it's very kshatriya. It's very warrior-like. We call it competition. It's very warrior-like. It's not knowledgeable, it's not scholarly, and it's not humane. But it is highly war-oriented. And very efficient. Does it look like war is happening when commerce takes place? We don't have bombs going off necessarily, yet it's highly competitive, which is what war is. So it's a style of life that we have that's totally warrior-oriented, and yet we don't even need a Colosseum like they had in Rome, because we've made it intrinsic to the fabric of life as we know it. Commerce is everything. Commerce defines everything. Commercial law defines all law. Any law you can think of comes under the umbrella of commercial law. So everything is looked at in terms of war. Everything. It's not a nice thought coming from a scholarly point of view. It can be very depressing. But from my point of view at the moment, it's not depressing because my whole life is at the bottom end of the stick. So, I... whatever. So it changes my perspective. So I can talk to you this way, and I think about electrical dynamics this way. With a chuckle. Instead of a whimpering or an angry, you know, kind of attitude. But it's really a question of logical thought in order to dismantle, to see how limited conservation is. Conservation is literally talking about the unity of God. That's literally what it's talking about. But creation is not the unity of God. Creation is the disassembly of that union of God into the multifarious factors of God, changing all the time, but unity never changes, and that's why it's always conserved. Only unity can be conserved, but multiplicity cannot. It's intrinsically in impossibility, and it's a self-contradiction. Okay? Anything anybody would tell you otherwise is a con job without the servation. It's not doing you any service. There's no servation there. It's strictly con without the service, without the servation. If you want to do a little wordplay there and use it as a way of explaining it in a very quick fashion, which doesn't say too much, but it's kind of cute and clever. Oh, I've been talking now for 40 minutes, not bad. And I'm dizzy just looking at my time on my cell phone. I better look back up again. Okay, enough talking.